Hi, I'm Neil Stavem. I want to thank you for listening to this podcast from Connecting Faith. There are many more podcasts available at our website, myfaithradio.com, and your support makes this possible.
Always expect something good on your lunch hour. Connecting Faith with Life.
Hi, welcome to Connecting Faith. We're honored to have you join us today here on the program. I'm Neil Stavem, Ted Ross with me, and it was just not that long ago when we were saddened to see and realize that we're still in the midst of a war on terror with the bombing in Belgium, and it just makes us wonder, you know, how does this fit with religion? Isn't Islam a religion of peace? We hear that oftentimes, and we're going to talk about it today.
Yes, and you know, our guest today actually had an article printed shortly after the Brussels bombing in the USA Today that ran an opinion piece by him, and he was just addressing this issue of terror, and he was pointing back to the actual Quran and what it really says about jihad and things like that.
We're going to find out today about Answering Jihad, A Better Way Forward. That's the title of the new book from our guest, Nabil Qureshi. You maybe heard him on Live the Promise not long ago. We're excited that we have the opportunity to talk with him. We had a chance to record with him a couple weeks ago, so it was before the Belgian bombing, but I hope that you'll listen in and get some great insight today.
What I also appreciate about Nabil is he approaches this with the heart of Christ. He wants to reach out to his Muslim brothers and sisters and share the gospel with them, so I can't wait to hear what he has to say about that.
We're honored today to spend some time with Nabil Qureshi. Dr. Qureshi is a global speaker with the Ravi Zacharias International Ministries, and he's the author of several books, including Seeking Allah, Finding Jesus, A Devout Muslim Encounters Christianity. And that was a well-recommended and awarded book. It received a Christian Book Award for categories of both Best New Author and Best Nonfiction. But his new book, the one we want to reference, is timely and important, and probably one that he didn't particularly want to write. It's called Answering Jihad, A Better Way Forward. And Nabil comes from a devout Muslim family and ended up coming to faith in Christ in his college years. And we've talked with him in the past about that story. We'll maybe touch on it as we go along. But Nabil, you addressed these issues and jihad, and I guess part of it was simply because current events kind of raise lots of questions for the people, and they were asking you, what's your opinion?
Yeah, the book was such a sort of a God-led thing. I was not wanting to talk about jihad at all, but then because of what was happening in the media, in the current events with San Bernardino and with Paris, and with Wheaton and the controversy there, I really felt like there was some voice that needed to speak basically what the truth was without giving up or compromising any of the compassion that we should speak it with.
And we want to address that as we go along. But maybe one of the big questions that always seems to come up when we're talking about Islam is that it is a religion of peace. And you suggest that maybe most Muslims perhaps believe that, so have they been taught incorrectly? Let's just start with that.
That's a great question. In Islam, you will constantly hear the slogan that Islam is a religion of peace, and the jarring thing about the slogan is that you'll often hear it after these major attacks. We heard it from George Bush after 9/11. We heard it after the 7/7 bombings in London, and of course we heard it recently again by Obama after the attack in San Bernardino. Muslims who say that Islam is a religion of peace say that usually because they mean it. In the West, that's how Islam has generally been taught to people. That's how I was taught Islam when I was growing up, that Islam is a religion of peace. But the problem is people have generally not looked at the sources themselves. They haven't understood the origins of Islam. What does it mean when we say Islam is a religion of peace? Do we mean that most Muslims are peaceful? Well, with that, I would have to agree. But that's not what's being said. When we say Islam is a religion of peace, we're talking about the religious system. We're talking about the teachings that Muhammad left, the teachings that are found in the Quran. And frankly, the first time Muhammad had the ability to fight, he did. The very first time he had people at his command to lead into battle, he did. And ever since then, he did until the time he died. And ever since then, Islam has been fighting battles. So it's not necessarily true in a historical sense or in a theological sense, but when Muslims say it in the West, they honestly mean it for the most part.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned a religious system. There are several foundational pillars, I guess, of Islam, right? The Muhammad, the Quran, those are two. There are others, though, too, right?
Correct. So when it comes to practices, there's five pillars of the practice of Islam. But when it really comes to the foundation of the religion itself, there really is the Quran and then Muhammad's life through the Hadith, which are the traditional sayings of Muhammad. And that's divided into two. There's the traditional sayings and the traditional actions that Muhammad took. But really, it's the Quran and Muhammad that form the foundation of Islam. And from those two comes Sharia, which was more or less codified a few hundred years after Muhammad died. And it changes, it ebbs, it flows. There's evolution to Sharia and thought of that nature. But all of it's founded in Muhammad's teachings and in the Quran.
Well, in the Quran, the word jihad is used. And, of course, that's the title of your book, Answering Jihad, A Better Way Forward. So what does the word jihad mean? And does it mean the same today as it did when it was written in the Quran?
That's a very astute question, because what it does mean now might be very different from what it used to mean. So the word jihad in Arabic means struggle, and it can be used in terms of a nonviolent struggle or spiritual struggle. But when you look in the Quran specifically, it generally means a struggle for religious purposes, and more often than not, it means a violent struggle. Then when you look at Muhammad's life, again, the next foundational pillar of Islam, you see that more often than not, far more often than not, the word jihad is used in terms of a physical battle or fight. And Muhammad even argues that people who come before Allah without scars on their body from jihad are deficient on the last day. So he actually expects Muslims all to be fighting. And that's the view of jihad that ultimately became codified in Islamic history. So by the time you have Sharia becoming developed in law books in Islam, you have a system of jihad. How should we wage war? What should be the purpose of jihad? On what terms should it end? Those kinds of questions on how to wage war through jihad have become codified hundreds of years after Muhammad. But the word itself throughout Islamic history since the time of Muhammad has meant a violent struggle for religious purposes.
So is it in fact is it a violent struggle to spread Islam, or is it defensive? Is it just protecting one's rights to practice?
And that's what I had been taught as a Muslim in the West. I had been taught that jihad was more or less for defensive purposes. Anytime Muhammad thought it was to defend the Muslim ummah, the Muslim people. But the reality is that's not really what the evidence shows. In fact, when I take a look at kind of battles in that period of history, I don't think people really thought in terms of offensive and defensive. They thought in terms of they are our enemies or are they not our enemies. And if they are your enemies, then they can attack you without provocation. You can attack them without provocation. Offensive and defensive really didn't show up. But that said, early in Islamic history, you had Muhammad, the first time he spilled blood as a Muslim people was in the year that he fled from Medina. In Medina, Muslims had been persecuted by Meccans, and so they were in a very defensive posture at the time, but they didn't have enough people to fight in a war. It wasn't until Muhammad fled to another city, according to the Islamic traditions, where now he had a whole city at his disposal to fight, and that's when he started launching raids against caravans. So the first time he had to fight, to live peacefully, he still chose to raid caravans. And then from that point on, the first major battle that Muslims fought was in the course of one of these raids, the Battle of Badr. And then we saw a lot of both offensive and defensive battles in Muhammad's life. The fact is, though, that Islam spread within 100 years of Muhammad's death, 100 to 150 years, Islam spread from the Atlantic Ocean to the valleys of India. So one-third of the known world was conquered by Muslims in about 150 years after Muhammad's death, and that could not have happened just defensively. It did not.
And so is it accurate to say that Islam is spread by the sword, and that those that want to follow Muhammad today are, in fact, just carrying out the founder's wishes?
It's complicated. I would say mostly yes, but we can't say that without qualification. Because when Islam would divide the world up, it was divided into, for the most part, two portions. There was the Darul Islam, the house of Islam, and there was Darul Harb, the house of war. In other words, those lands that were Muslim were a place where peace would reign, and then those lands that were not Muslim, that's where you could fight. It was constantly at war. There was a third division called Darul Sulh, which means house of treaty. But for the most part, it was divided into you can fight or you cannot fight. Well, when Muslims wanted to attack a place in Darul Harb, what they had to do first was offer those people the chance to peacefully become Muslim or to peacefully pay taxes in subjugation to Muslims, so like a tribute or a ransom tax. If those places chose to go one of those routes, either convert or pay this tax, then they wouldn't be fought by the Muslims. And a lot of places we know did that. Some of those places just converted. Some of those places chose to pay the tax. And so you can't then really argue that Islam was spread by the sword because they didn't actually fight. But it was under the threat of the sword. It was under the risk of jihad. So indirectly, yes, Islam spread almost everywhere where we see it in the world today. It is there because at some point there were Islamic conquests that conquered that land.
We're having our conversation today with Nabil Qureshi because we experience and are aware of growing terror around the world and those that claim jihad, fighting in the name of Allah and Islam. And there's lots of, you know, conversation about is this really peaceful? Do these people really represent Islam? We're talking about it today with Dr. Nabil Qureshi, who is a global speaker with Ravi Zacharias International Ministries. He's a best-selling author. He lectures around the globe, actually, and has told his story of his conversion to Christianity in a wonderful book called Seeking Allah, Finding Jesus. We're going to hear more in a moment as we ask some questions about how radicalism seems to be growing and what we might do to respond to it. And we'll do that in just a moment as we continue here on Connecting Faith. You're listening to Connecting Faith, talking today with Nabil Qureshi, a best-selling author and itinerant speaker with the Ravi Zacharias International Ministries. His latest book is called Answering Jihad, A Better Way Forward, and this was written in response to some of the recent attacks. Of course, we can go back to September 11 or the World Trade bombings in 1993 when it seemed that the U.S. suddenly became a little more aware of what's going on. But Nabil, there is this reluctance to even suggest that, you know, we use the word Islam when we're talking about extremists or jihadists. Maybe there's a couple extremes here in the West. We have the unwillingness to use the word, or maybe we suggest that we close the border to all Muslims. So let's talk about what a balanced approach should look like today.
Yeah, I'm glad you're asking that question because that was really what drove me to write this book, is because you have some people who say that Islam is a religion of peace and the terrorists are not actually representing Islam. And I appreciate that heart. I appreciate that that's compassion that's driving that message, compassion for Muslims in the West who might be innocent. But it's not entirely true. Then on the other hand of the spectrum, you have people who are saying that Islam is inherently violent and therefore all Muslims must be latent threats because they follow this violent religion. Now, that's a problem too because it paints all Muslims with the same brush, so it doesn't think about people as individuals, but also it doesn't have much compassion. So the reason I called my book Answering Jihad, A Better Way Forward is I want to try to advance the notion that we can be both compassionate and truthful when responding to jihad, the compassion of the left and the truth of the right working hand in hand. I think that's the best way to move forward on responding to jihad.
You know, some would say, well, there just needs to be a reformation of Islam. You know, we think about the Protestant Reformation. There just needs to be a reformation in Islam. You address that and suggest that maybe what we're seeing is, in fact, an attempt at reformation.
Yeah, I think when we think of the Reformation, we think of the Crusades happening, and we think of all these issues in the church, the Reformation, where people returned back to the scriptures, and they returned back to the thinking of, and teachings of Jesus, and everyone became peaceful, and grace reigned. I think it's an interesting notion of the Reformation, but one that then bleeds into other views of religions that could use a reformation, specifically Islam. And we assume that if Islam had its reformation, then all of a sudden Muslims would be peaceful and would pursue enlightenment and this and that. I think that's caricatured. I think the reality is what a reformation does in religions is it tends to return people, reform around the original faith. And in the case of Christianity, yeah, that was the teachings of Jesus. But in the case of Islam, if Islam had a reformation, that would return people to the teachings of Muhammad and the Quran. Well, therein lies the problem, because it was in Muhammad's life that we see a tremendous crescendo of violence. Like I said, he was living peacefully for the first few years when he was in Mecca, mainly because he didn't have the option to fight. But then when he could fight, he started fighting these battles, and he fought them until he died at a rate of 9-plus battles a year. He either fought or commissioned these battles. And when he then died, right before he died, the last major chapter of the Quran comes out. And the Quran, by the way, is not in chronological order. So chapter 9 of the Quran is the last chapter to have been revealed, the last major chapter. It also happens to be the most violent chapter. And so when you read through chapter 9 of the Quran, it says things like, slay the infidels wherever you find them, lay siege to them, take them captive. And you see verses that tell Muslims to fight Jews and Christians until they pay the jizya, which is the ransom tax, and feel subjugated. That's chapter 9, verse 29 of the Quran. And the reason why, you get a few verses later in chapter 9, verse 33, Islam is to be the religion that prevails over all other religions. So this is really about the superiority of Islam. So the last major chapter of the Quran is the most violent. Muhammad goes in this crescendo of violence until he dies. So if we have a reformation, if we point people back to the Quran and to Muhammad's life, what we're going to see is an increasing embrace of violence. By the way, that was the intentional mission statement of the Muslim Brotherhood in 1928. When it was established, it was, we want to follow the Quran and Muhammad's life. And it wasn't necessarily as violent as it became. But because it had those founding principles, it ultimately did become violent. So what we're seeing then around the world is people such as Al-Qaeda, Boko Haram, ISIS, all of them derive their ideology from a man named Sayyid Qutb, who was a part of the Muslim Brotherhood. And his whole view was that in modern times, Muslim nations have departed from the teachings of Muhammad and the Quran. In order to become superior again, the Muslim people, in order for them to rise above the West and the East, in his day the East was communism and the West was capitalism, in order for Islam to rise above that, it needs to follow Muhammad, it needs to follow a Quran, we need the Reformation. And the result of that has been radical Islam. So radical Islam today, I think, is the Islamic Reformation.
So can moderate Muslims hope to have any influence on the apparently growing number of radicals? So what's it going to take to repudiate terror?
Yeah, and that's really where the rubber meets the road here. How are we going to stop this? Because I don't think it's going to stop by itself. And the reason why is because if you think about the mechanisms here, if you think about the mechanics of it, how are people becoming more radicalized? How are they going back to the roots all of a sudden of the Quran and Muhammad's life, and therefore becoming more and more violent? And the answer is it's the internet. It's the accessibility that they have to the Quran, to the traditions of Muhammad's life. In the past, there was no accessibility to these things. Yeah, the Quran existed in lots of places, but no one spoke Quranic Arabic, really. Even today, in Arabic-speaking countries, people speak modern colloquial forms of Arabic, not Quranic forms of Arabic. And so in order to learn what the Quran said, in order to learn what Muhammad used to say, they'd have to go places and learn from their teachers. They couldn't actually access it. Today, if you want to know what the Quran says, you just pick up your iPhone. If you want to look at the traditions and the hadith, see how Muhammad lived, the battles that he fought, pick up your phone, go online. And because of that accessibility, I don't think this is going to end anytime soon. So how are the moderate Muslims going to turn around the more radical ones? It's going to be very, very difficult, if not near impossible. So what's happening, and here's why I think we're seeing such an increase in radicalization, and why we're seeing an increase also in people leaving Islam at unprecedented numbers. I think they're both derived from the same phenomenon, which is that Muslims are being taught Islam is like this, and then they're given their traditional teaching of Islam, whatever that might be. In my case, I was from the Ahmadi sect of Islam. Some people might come from more peaceful, more violent sects, what have you. They're told whatever they're told in their mosques by their leaders and by their elders. But when they're confronted with the reality of Islam, when they read the Quran or they read the traditions of Muhammad's life, and they're confronted with the reality, they reach a trifold fork in the road, and they have to make a decision. They think, either I have to be nominal, either I have to start ignoring my Islamic faith because I don't want to follow the stuff that I'm seeing in the Quran and the Hadith, so maybe I'll just be nominal. Or they think, I'm going to become an apostate. I'm going to leave Islam. I can't follow this anymore. And that's what happened to me. I saw these traditions and I said, there's no way I can follow this. Or there's the third route, which is to become radicalized, to say, okay, I see these traditions. I now know what Muhammad actually taught, what the Quran actually teaches, and I want to follow it so that I can be a good Muslim. And these people are usually teenagers who are passionate for their faith. They're people who really believe in their tradition and their culture. So I actually feel for them. I mean, we cast them as terrorists, and what they do is evil. But usually these are teenage boys who've just been passionate about God. And so what I think, nominal Muslims are going to have a very difficult time changing their minds, because what are they going to say? Follow Islam, but not really? What's going to have to happen is they're either going to have to reimagine Islam from the inside out, which you have progressive Muslims who are trying to do that, thought leaders in progressive scholarly circles who are trying to do that, but it's not working. Or you're going to have Muslims who say, well, don't read these sources yourself. Go to the scholars. Go to your traditional schools and learn from them. And in fact, here at Oxford the other day, I attended a meeting where a Muslim scholar was saying exactly that. He was telling Muslims, don't read the sources yourselves. You won't understand them. The problem is they will understand them, is the issue. The real answer, I think, will have to come from the outside. It'll have to come from probably Christians who are willing to love people who could be their enemies, and introduce them to a better way, introduce them to the gospel. That's what I think is going to have to happen.
We're addressing it today with Dr. Nabil Qureshi, who is a speaker with the Ravi Zacharias International Ministries, author of several books, including Seeking Allah, Finding Jesus, A Devout Muslim Encounters Christianity, where he tells his story about after being raised as a devout Muslim and in the United States and engaging in a conversation about Christianity. It stretched over a year or so and has become an apologist for the faith. And he's written this new book called Answering Jihad, A Better Way. It is from Zondervan. We've got a couple copies to give away and would love to make sure that you get one. You can sign up today on email by going to myfaithradio.com and then click on the Connecting Faith show page and give us your contact information. We'll put you in the drawing for that Answering Jihad, the new book from Nabil Qureshi. We'll talk more with him in just a moment as we continue here on Connecting Faith. You're listening to Connecting Faith, and today we're talking with Dr. Nabil Qureshi. We've had the opportunity to talk with him in the past, and I highly recommend his story, which was award-winning, best-selling book called Seeking Allah, Finding Jesus, A Devout Muslim Encounters Christianity, and you will get a much better understanding of understanding Islam and how we might effectively share the gospel with those who are questioning their faith. As we've talked these past few minutes, to say that there are many Muslims today that are facing a fork in the road, and they either have to abandon their faith or they have to pursue it with passion. And we're seeing that that's growing radicalism in many cases. Nabil, just maybe to summarize, I can't do it in a few minutes, but say a little bit about your story. And I'm wondering if the words Muslim and Islam are interchangeable and how you maybe approached Christianity as you were growing up in the United States.
Yeah, I do think that's a problem when we conflate the term Muslim and Islam. And a lot of people do that. And the issue with that is a Muslim is a person. Islam is a series of beliefs, or it's even more complicated than that. It's like a religio-political, social, legal system is what Islam is. But Muslims are people. And so the way I see it, Muslims are people who are image bearers of God. Any human is an image bearer of God, and we're supposed to treat them with love and respect like Jesus told us to. Whereas Islam, I think, is something that shouldn't garner that degree of our care as far as respect is concerned. If there's something dangerous that Islam teaches, we should be able to say it. If there's something inherently violent about Islam, we should be able to critique it, and that not be seen as a critique of a person, but of a system. So that's why I think we have to be very careful and tease these things out. Now, as far as my personal journey is concerned, I was raised as a devout Muslim in the U.S., thinking that Islam was a religion of peace, thinking that it was the true monotheism, that Christians in particular were actually polytheists because they believed in a trinity, which was actually three gods. I always asked Christians to explain to me how it wasn't three gods, and no one ever was able, so I just figured it's veiled polytheism. And so I was introducing these polytheists to the true monotheism. That's how I thought about Christianity. It wasn't until I ran into a Christian who was able to start defending his faith, explaining why the Bible was reliable, how the Trinity wasn't polytheism, how it was actually monotheism, being able to show me that Jesus claimed to be God and rose from the dead to prove it. All these things are denied by Islam. And so studying then the historical evidence for Christianity in contradistinction to the historical evidence for Islam, I realized that the case for Christianity, and I mean that seriously, the evidence, the evidential case for Christianity was quite strong, whereas the case for Islam was quite weak. The truth claims were very problematic. And it was realizing that I started asking God to guide me personally, and I asked for dreams and visions, which is what Muslims often do. And through a vision and three dreams, God led me to the scriptures, to the Bible. And it was in the pages of the New Testament that I encountered God powerfully. And that's when I gave my life to Christ.
Nabil, not long ago on a Christian college at Wheaton, there was some concern about a professor who said, you know, we're standing in solidarity with Muslims because we worship the same God. That seems to be an ongoing question that comes up more and more. Do we worship the same God as Muslims?
Yeah, I think this is a very important question for us to tackle, especially in light of the fact that we're called to tell people about God. And do we tell Muslims that you're worshiping the right one, or do we have to reframe the conversation? The first thing I would like to say is this is a much more complicated matter than people realize. I, as a believer in Christ, for the first, I'd say, 7 to 8 years that I had as a Christian, I thought that Muslims and Christians worship the same God, except that Muslims got it wrong, basically. I thought, well, you have the right God, but you understand him incorrectly. I no longer believe that. After having studied the issue a bit more, quite a bit more, here's the problem. Christianity is built on a message of a triune God who exists because God is triune. I want our listeners to understand this. If God is three persons, that means that God loves himself. Well, you can't call himself because himself refers to persons. The three persons of God love one another, have loved one another for eternity because God has always existed as three persons. So love has been the founding principle are the foundational principle of God throughout history. And so when God created this world, he created it out of love. We personally, as individuals, when we treat one another with love, when Jesus tells us, love the Lord your God with all your heart, soul, mind, strength, and love your neighbor as yourself, it's because God wove into this very universe the principle of love, because that's who he is. And that's why love is the center of the Christian faith, because of the Trinity. In Islam, that is not at all the case. God is not unconditionally loving. He is not a father. He is not a son. In fact, in Surah 5 of the Quran, verse 18, God tells Muslims to rebuke Christians and Jews for saying they are children of God and his beloved. They are not. So it's a very different notion of who God is. So what Islam sets up as its central tenet of faith is called Tawheed. So the central doctrine of Islam is Tawheed. Well, what is Tawheed? Essentially, it's a rejection of the Trinity. It's saying that God is monadic. He's one person and one being. And so not only do you have Muslims who happen to not worship a triune God, that would be one thing, but they're following a system that was built on the explicit rejection of the Trinity and an establishment of an antithetical, a diametrically opposed doctrine. And that's why I think you cannot say that Muslims and Christians worship the same God.
Should we here in the West be concerned about, as Islam continues to grow, more and more Muslims come to the United States, many refugees, but is there, you know, we've seen some examples of attempts to maybe create Sharia law. Is that something that we have to be concerned about?
I think concern is a good word. What bothers me a lot, Neil, is when I see people who are responding with fear. Because they're thinking, okay, refugees are coming. Some of these guys could be ISIS. My life might be in jeopardy. What do I do to protect myself? And they respond out of fear. The problem I have with that is Jesus never taught us to respond out of fear. In fact, we have the exact opposite told to us in Scripture in 2 Timothy 1:7. We have not been given a spirit of fear, but a spirit of power and love and self-control. What does Jesus do in the face of violence? The fact of the matter is he receives it, and he is willing to lay down his life even for those who are killing him that they may be saved. And then he tells us, as I have loved you, so love one another. To be a Christian is to be following Jesus. And if Jesus was willing to face violence head on and even die for the sake of those who needed to know about his love, we have to follow him. So my suggestion is to not respond out of fear. But it gets better than that, because most Muslims are not trying to kill us. Like I said, the vast majority of Muslims are trying to just live peaceful lives. They don't know their father, and we get to introduce them to their father. And so when Muslims are coming to the United States, I don't think we should respond out of fear. Maybe concern for the innocents around us. I think that's a noble response. If we're thinking, okay, I don't want innocent people around me. I don't want their lives to be endangered. My life is forfeit for the sake of Christ. But the other people around me, I want them to be safe and protected. Okay, that's a much more noble response than fearing for your own life. But at the same time, we have to remember that these refugees are also mostly, for the most part, innocent people who are trying to flee ISIS. They don't want ISIS in their life any more than we do. And the fact that we were born in the United States is a privilege that God has given us. And to those whom much has been given, much shall be required, says Luke chapter 12, verse 48. So I think we should see this as an opportunity to reach people with the love of Christ. These refugees would probably never have heard the gospel in Iraq or Syria. Whereas here in the U.S., we can embrace them, bring them into our homes, help them learn English, help them learn how to drive, supply them with mattresses, and in the midst of all that, let them know of our love for Christ. Because they think anybody in the West, and frankly, people from Muslim countries see the world in, unfortunately, rather diametric senses, in black or white ways. You're either Christian or you're not. In the West, people are Christian. That's how they see it. So they're expecting you to share the gospel with them. When people come from foreign countries, they're expecting Christians to share the gospel. I think that should be what we do. Love them as Jesus loved people. He healed them. He provided for them bread and fish. We've seen that too. But he also showed his love for the Father, and we should be doing both at the same time and not seeing this as an opportunity to fear or panic, but to reach the world for the sake of the kingdom.
Mm-hmm. And as you said earlier, there's kind of several choices to take, and one is to pursue more radicalization, but the other is to pursue something else. And I think we've discovered that, right? Maybe you can talk about that. Has the increased radicalization of Islam provided some maybe fertile ground for the gospel to spread?
Absolutely. We started seeing this in Iran first. So the revolution in Iran in the 70s brought clerics into power. And for a good few decades, people were willing to give Islam a shot. You have to understand, Neil, that in the heart of most Muslims, there's this yearning for the golden age of Islam. they have in their mind, in the zeitgeist of these Islamic communities, this idea that Islam is beautiful, that Sharia is beautiful, and that at some point Allah will vindicate Muslims and raise Islam back to where it should be. And in order to do that, we should follow Islam. We should let Sharia be the ruling law of the land. We saw that happen in Iran first, and Muslims boldly followed through with their desire for Sharia to rule. Well, when that started happening, things started falling apart, and for the most part, people in Iran were not fans of what was going on. A lot of them started fleeing from the country. A lot of Iranian refugees, for example, were received in Australia, and at that point, these people said, "We are sick and tired of Islam. We want something else. What do you have to share with us?" And these Muslims were becoming Christians in droves, and now pastors from Iran are very common in Australia, and they're some of the most passionate Christians, those who had formerly been Muslims in Iran. So that happened there, and then we saw the same thing happen with the Arab Spring in Egypt. The Egyptians voted in the Muslim Brotherhood, saying, "We want Sharia, we want Islamic principles." And within a year, they ousted the Muslim Brotherhood, and a lot of those people were then persecuted, the Muslim Brotherhood was, because they said, "What did you do to us? You didn't fulfill your promises." Well, actually, they did. They were trying to impose Islamic law over the nation, and the Muslims realized that's not what they wanted. A very interesting poll was taken right before the Arab Spring started, and right after in Egypt. Right before the Arab Spring, 99% of people polled in Egypt said they believed in God's existence. Right after, when the Muslim Brotherhood was in power, the same poll was conducted, and 70% said they believed in God. So people are really changing their perspectives now. It's the perfect opportunity to say there is a better message, there is a gospel message, and to share this right now is the best opportunity we've ever had in human history for Muslims to come to know the Lord.
We're talking with Nabil Qureshi about the new book, Answering Jihad, A Better Way Forward. It's new from Zondervan. Nabil has written a best-selling book called "The Best Seeking Allah, Finding Jesus." It was awarded Best New Author and Best Nonfiction. Nabil is a speaker with the Ravi Zacharias International Ministries. He holds degrees in medicine from Eastern Virginia Medical School, Christian apologetics from Biola, and religion at Duke University, and is pursuing a doctorate in New Testament studies at Oxford University. We've got some copies of Answering Jihad to give away. We'll do that via email. You can be a part of the drawing by going to myfaithradio.com and then clicking on the Connecting Faith show page, and give us your contact information. And we have a few more minutes with Nabil. We'll continue in just a moment here on Connecting Faith. Talking today with Nabil Qureshi, and so honored to have some time with him about this wonderful new important resource called Answering Jihad, A Better Way Forward. And I think many of us have just wondered, how can this radicalization be taking place before our eyes? We wonder at the evil that seems so evident. I guess, Nabil, maybe you can speak to what is the appeal for radicalization? I mean, is life not precious to a radical? And maybe as a follow-up, why are young women suddenly attracted to this? That's even more frightening, it seems.
Yeah. Goodness, it's so interesting to read the responses from the radical Muslims versus the Westerners when they see some of these events happening. For example, in San Bernardino, you had a couple who went and committed what they called a martyrdom operation, basically killing as many people as they can until they get killed. In the West, people thought, what kind of monster is this woman that she could leave her child and then go kill people? In the Middle East, in radical areas, people were saying, well, now people will realize just how passionate we are to fulfill the word of God. We're even willing to leave our children in pursuit of our desire to please God. That was what they were saying. And you can actually read ISIS's magazine online and see that that's how they thought that message would come across. Fact of the matter is that those who are doing this are doing it because they believe they are following God. And a lot of people are missing that. In the West, they're trying to find completely secular reasons for why people would become radicalized. Oh, it has to do with money, said some people from certain governmental organizations. They'll say people didn't have jobs, and therefore they're going out and committing these atrocities. Not at all. Studies show that it's the most educated people who are more likely to become radicalized. As we saw in San Bernardino, it was a man who was making $70,000 a year and had a bachelor's education. So that's just not true. Some people are saying it's because they want to find identity. Well, that's closer to the mark, but what identity is it that they're trying to find? Specifically, it's their Muslim heritage. The factor that plays into every single radicalization story that we have is Islam. It's ISIS pointing out, this is what Muhammad said. This is what the Quran says. Don't you want to follow your religion? Don't you want to follow what Allah has told you to follow? And it's because of that drive, that desire for people to do what is holy, to earn the pleasure of Allah. Some of them have made mistakes in their life, and they're told that the only way that they can go to heaven for sure is if they die in martyrdom, which means suicide attacks. So for these reasons of intended piety, a lot of these young people are going to the Middle East. Yeah, some of it is adventure seeking. And for some of the girls, it's a little bit of freedom that they want. Their houses might be stifling to them. Their parents are going to pick their husband for them, and they want to have their own freedom. And here's a nation that tells you you can pick your own husband. And ISIS does, by the way, tell Western Muslim girls that if they come to Syria, they can pick their own husband. And they sometimes do follow through with that. I'm not saying they're lying. But these are the draws for some people, to be sure. But what's present in every single story, without a doubt, is the enjoinment on these Muslim young people, for the most part, to fulfill their Islamic duty and to come out to fight.
So is there a way to maybe rationally critique Islam? I mean, the defending the honor of Muhammad has gotten, it has led, terrorist acts for, those that have been badly portraying Mohammedan cartoons or something. I mean, can we actually have any sort of honest dialogue about this?
It's very difficult when we conflate the issue of Muslims and Islam, and we're coming back to that issue now. But if you say a critique of Islam is a critique of Muslims, then people are going to react viscerally and say, how dare you hate people? And they're going to throw out the label of Islamophobia. So the first thing we have to do, and that's why I'm trying to lay this principle in my book, Answering Jihad, is to say that Muslims are not Islam. And when we critique Islam, we're not critiquing people. Once we do that, once people understand that, then we can do much more about critiquing Islam. But until that happens, you're going to get the accusation of Islamophobia tossed out to you. There was actually a woman who is a Muslim herself who's been working with the Clarion Project to say that there are issues with Islam. Now, again, she is herself a Muslim, and she's been pointing out the issues that exist in the system of Islam. And what response is she getting from the Muslim community? They're calling her an Islamophobe, but she's Muslim. But the fact is, if you critique Islam in the West, even if you're a Muslim, you'll get the title Islamophobe. And we need to change that. And the way that will happen is by emphasizing the difference between Islam and Muslims.
Nabil, as you said, laying out this book, answering these many questions, important questions that I think we've all had. But, the subtitle says A Better Way Forward, and we've sort of touched on it. But recap what that should look like as followers of Christ. What is that better way forward?
It's to first realize that, again, Muslims are people, and they are trapped. According to the terminology of 2 Timothy chapter 2, these are people who are trapped for whom we should pray. We shouldn't see them as our enemies. Even if they see themselves as our enemies, Christ told us that if our enemy is hungry, give them something to eat, or if they're thirsty, give them something to drink. So we're supposed to see these people as people we should pray for. And quite frankly, I'm thinking about my mom and my dad. And if you see a Muslim in the grocery store, you might be seeing my parents. And I do not want you to be afraid. I would much, much rather you extend some love to them. My parents, my mom in particular, has been in the United States since the mid-70s, and never once has a Christian who's in her neighborhood or who lives around her, never once have they invited her into their home or just extended Christian love to them. And so we're failing in our duty as followers of Christ to receive the world with love. We'd much rather stay in our Christian bubbles and go to our churches and go to our Bible studies and not do what Jesus told us to do, which is to be in the world but not of the world. So that's step number one, is to actually reach out to Muslims in love, understand that they are people. And then number two, to be a voice of reason. When people start saying things like Islam is a religion of peace, to just ask the question, what do you mean by that? And it's very difficult to do that with the required sort of propriety such that people don't think you're attacking. So pray for the Holy Spirit to give you wisdom and discernment on how to say these kinds of things. But represent the voice of truth here. Don't let falsehood be perpetuated, because that's only going to endanger more people. The fact is that responding in fear endangers honest Muslims and sincere Muslims like my family, but ignoring the issue, as a lot of people do, by saying Islam is a religion of peace, endangers our whole nation. And so we need to, as a body of Christ, we need to be able to tread that path of both truth and compassion. I would say also that as people are coming to the West, they need to see the love of Christ. Not just hear about it. People don't care about what you say. They care a lot more about what you do. And so if you start reaching out to Muslims, if you start helping refugees who are coming, and not just hitting them over the head with the gospel, I mean, definitely share the gospel with them, but also actually love them the way Jesus fed whole crowds, not bothering to check with them whether or not they had believed he was the Messiah first. You know, love people and proclaim the gospel at the same time. If you do that, if you just follow Christ in the simple command of love the Lord your God with all your heart, soul, mind, strength, and love your neighbor as yourself, I think we'll go a very, very long way forward in answering jihad.
Nabil, what might you say to someone who is trying to follow Islam and they're faced with this trifold fork in the road, the apathy, apostasy, or radicalism? What would you suggest to those? Maybe you have conversations and have opportunities to raise issues. What's the approach?
Yeah, I would say if you are seeing the violence of Islam, as I did in 2001, when I believed Islam was a religion of peace and I saw the Twin Towers fall down, I was struck with the violence of Islam, and I spent so much time trying to defend Islam and say, no, this isn't what Islam is actually like. Those people hijacked Islam. Study the sources. Take a look at what Muhammad said. This is the man that we all professed allegiance to when we say the Shahada. Is he really a man of peace or not? And once you see the violence there, once you see what he actually said, I want to assure you that there is another option. Realize that Jesus actually is not what Islam said. Islam came 600 years after Jesus, 600 miles away from Jesus, and it taught things about Jesus that are not what Jesus actually said. I would encourage you to look at Jesus' own words. Just pick up the Bible and read for yourself what Jesus actually said and whom you would rather follow, Muhammad or Jesus.
It's our prayer that many would pursue that, to read the words of Jesus, and that as we hear it, as followers of Christ, that we would find ways to reach out in love and compassion to our neighbors and many new neighbors coming our way, and for the sake of advancing God's kingdom, that we do that. Nabil, thank you so much for taking on this. I know your policy analysis is not really your thing, but appreciate you addressing it so well in this new book.
Thanks, Neil. I'm honored to have been on the show. I appreciate it.
If you want to find out more, you can go to answeringjihad.com as a website, just to find out a little bit more about the book, Answering Jihad, A Better Way Forward, and you can discover more about Dr. Nabil Qureshi, who's the itinerant speaker with Ravi Zacharias International Ministries, has several degrees, and is a gifted communicator, and we're honored to have him with us today on Connecting Faith. And of course, if you missed part of our conversation or would like to pass it on to a friend, you can find it posted online. Go to myfaithradio.com and then click on the Connecting Faith show page for the podcast archives.